October 8th, 2009. My name is Jessica Drysdale. I'm here with Jay Lutz, and we are interviewing Reverend Walter Moon at the Hattie Wilson Library. Reverend Moon, I guess if we can just start out with you telling us a little bit about your background.
First of all, it is a pleasure for me to be here and to take part in this lesson for you. I am a native of Marietta, Cobb County. I'm a graduate of this very building that we're in. I was in the fifth grade when this building was constructed. So I spent grades 5, 6, 7, and 8 in this particular building here. That's one of the reasons it has such a significance to the Black community. And of course, the old wooden structure that was here. I started first grade in the old wooden structure that was here. And of course, the high school, which was across the street, initially was Perkinson High. And then later on, it was changed to Lemon Street High. And I graduated in 1958 from Lemon Street. It's an interesting parallel because at that time, it was, the Deep South was extremely segregated. And we had the only high school in all of Cobb County was Lemon Street High. And all of the Black students, once they reached high school age, no matter where they lived in the county, whether it was Atwork, Kennesaw, Powder Springs, Austell, any municipality in the county, once you reached high school age, the Black kids were required to go to Lemon Street. And so that was where all high school students, Black in Cobb County, attended high school in Lemon Street. There were numerous advantages and disadvantages that came out as a result of that. From an athletic standpoint, we were always had a good basketball team and a good football team. As a matter of fact, we challenged to play Marietta High School football, and because of segregation, it never came to pass. But in 1966, when the schools did integrate, we had a carryover of an enormous number of our football players. And interesting enough, the year after that was the year that Marietta High won the state championship. That was on the plus side. On the downside, this being the only high school in the entire county, we would get what we call hand-me-down supplies and books, etc., from primarily from Marietta High School. And a lot of the books that we would get, some of the pages were missing, covers missing on some of them, and some of them were in fairly good condition. I suppose probably the greatest disadvantage was the curriculum that we had here was inferior to the curriculum that they had at the other high schools in the county. But that was soon rectified. I think probably another downside, as we think about in retrospect, the students here prior to desegregation, it seemed that they had a much closer relationship with the teachers than when we initially desegregated, and the Black students were for lack of another word, were thrust into a situation where that personal relationship, that parental type guidance that they received from the teachers was no more. Mm-hmm. So I think that was probably a disadvantage. Like I indicated, I graduated from Lemon Street in 1958. And at that time, we had 42 students in our class, which was the largest class to graduate from Lemon Street up to that point. And we had 21 boys and 21 girls.
That's easy to remember.
I look now, and when we look at, I'm on a committee with the Maryland City School System now. One of the things that we're tracking is the percentage of blacks that are graduating from high school. And right now, there's a considerable gap between the number of black boys that's graduating and the number of black girls that's graduating. And what we're looking to do is to see what can be done to elevate the number of black boys that's graduating where it would be comparable to the overall graduation rate and at least close to the number of black girls that are graduating. I think the last stats that we looked at, all total, there was about 83% of students attending Merida High School graduating. I think it's like 79% of the girls, the black girls, 79% of the black girls graduate. But when it comes to the black boys, I think it drops down to like about 72%. So,
yeah.
Right there. But it's kind of interesting. All of my adult life, with the exception of a 12-year period, I've lived here in the Merida Cobb area. For 12 years, my job carried me to various other parts of the South and the Northeast. And 7 years ago, after I retired, I spent a couple of years in Birmingham because of the ministry. And then when I retired, my wife and I came back home here because this is where our children and our grandchildren are. Mm-hmm. And we are four generations of Merida Public School System. So that's how long we've been around. From the standpoint of involvement, and I don't know if you want to go into that or if you have particular questions that you would like to ask, but my involvement, so far as the movement is concerned, began in 1964 when I was discharged from the Navy. Mm-hmm. And I'll share an experience with you, and then I'll relent. I joined the Navy in 1960, and the company that I was with in boot camp, we had a total of 84 recruits, four black recruits, and 80 white recruits. And up until that point that I went in the Navy at age 20, it's ironic because up until I was age 20, I had never touched a white person. That's how segregated it was. And I think a lot of blacks, because of growing up in a segregated society, even though it may not have been knowingly, they had an inferiority complex because of the way we had been treated all through the years. So when I went in the Navy and I realized, I said, I don't see really any difference from that standpoint. So that was a tremendous learning experience for me. And during the time from 1960 to 1964, if you will recall, that was particularly in 1963 and 1964, that was the time of the upheaval and the turmoil that was taking place in Montgomery, Alabama, and in Birmingham, Alabama, particularly with Bull Connor and the dogs, the fire hoses.
Right.
All of that took place during the time that I was in the Navy. Well, I indicated that there were only four blacks in my unit. But when I went aboard ship, I was in the navigation game. I'm on aircraft carrier. With the air complement, it carried about 5,000 sailors. You could count of the 5,000 sailors, three people could count all the blacks on both hands and on board that ship. I was the only black in my division on the ship. And when we were in port, we had what we call a swing room. And we could go in the swing room, and we had a large television, and we could watch television. Well, if some of the guys in the division decided that they would not go ashore, but they were going to stay and hang out on the ship or whatever, we would watch TV. And at that time, everything on the news was about Birmingham, Alabama. The 16th Street Church that was bombed, four black girls that lost their lives. This was, everything was there. Well, in the military, particularly in the Navy, aboard ship, just as in any other branch, you're so close to your shipmates and everything, that there's a family type atmosphere aboard ship. So when we were sitting in the swing room and watched the news, and everybody else in that swing room, 25, 30, sometimes 40 people, 39 white and one black. And every channel that you look at, you're seeing what's taking place in Birmingham, Alabama. And surprisingly, not one time did one of the shipmates ask me about it, because it was like they were afraid to talk to me about it. And I didn't want to talk to them about it because I was angry. Seeing what was happening.
So can you expand more on your feelings at the time, like being away, not being able to be a part of these things, but you're seeing the images on television?
That, the experience that I had and that I witnessed there was one of the primary driving factors that in 1964, when I was discharged, I decided I believe I can make a difference. And seeing all of that happen, being there in the Navy, and you have strict guidelines in the Navy about what you can and what you can't do. So I said, well, there's nothing really I can do about it now. But when I get out, I'm going to be determined to do what I can do to make a difference. And I think that was the starting point. And I say that was the starting point of my involvement in the civil rights movement, even though I was still in the Navy. But because of that setting that I just described to you, that motivated me to, as soon as I was discharged, and I said, hey, I'm going to see if I can make a difference. And at the time, Hugh Grogan, he was still living in New York. And shortly after I was discharged, he relocated back to Marietta. He's a native of Marietta, but he was living in Harlem, predominantly black section in New York City. And shortly after I was discharged, he relocated back to Marietta, and we began to collaborate and to say, okay, what is it that we can do to make a difference? And that was the starting point.
All right, so what was your involvement with the civil rights movement? Do you have any specific stories?
There were several areas that that we were involved in here. One being The first effort that we made was we noticed that there were zero blacks on the police department and the fire department. So we started to protest. And we went to, I never will forget, we went to one of the city council meetings, filled the council, black folk. And we were protesting about the fact that they had no black firemen and no black policemen. And the question was raised, how many blacks have applied and taken the fireman and policeman's exam? And that taught us a lesson because we had not done our homework and researching to say, okay, how many have we really had? And we couldn't put our finger on the number that had actually applied and had taken the police and the fireman's exam. So what we did, we regrouped. And at the time, I was living on Lemon Street here at 436 Lemon Street, which they call the Hill, okay? And we started to mobilize in my basement. We said, first of all, what we need to do is find out what type of information is on the police and the firemen's exam. So I took the exam. Once we found out, I passed the exam. Once we found out the type of information that was on the exam, we began to get classes in my basement. And from those classes, we had individuals who agreed that they would take the exam. And at the same time now, we are marching and we're protesting. And the media, anytime the media gets wind of some activity like that, they were always there. So as we protested, this got media attention. So we also now had other blacks that were saying, hey, if they don't have any policemen or any black firemen in Marietta, we'll go there and we'll take that exam. So that protesting and the coverage that we were getting in the media was also like marketing, because it opened up a wide area for people to come in. And as a result of that, the very first black policeman that was hired was a young man by the name of Charles Hayden. He was the first black policeman that was hired. And everybody thought it was a big thing, but what it did, it opened up the door for other blacks from that standpoint. Just recently, we had the first black police commander. Can't think of his name now, but he was promoted to a commander, to one of three commanders in the Marietta City Police Department from that standpoint. The other thing that we did, back during that time, in 1966, when separate but equal was ruled unconstitutional, when they began to integrate the schools, we had we still only had Lemon Street as the only high school, and we pretty much knew that the high school was going to go. But we also had several elementary schools in the black community, and it appeared that the Marietta School Board was going to systematically close all of the black schools and move all of the black kids out of the black community into the white community where the schools were. They were not going to send any white kids into the black community, but send all of the black kids out of the black community into the white community. So we began to protest that. And as a result, we were able for a good while keep this school going and to keep Henry Drive, which is now long since gone. We were able to keep Henry Drive. There were a couple of borderline schools, Park Street Elementary. I don't know if y'all remember Park Street, but it was kind of like a borderline. And it's still open right now from that standpoint. If we did a carry-on from that, as we would escalate our protests, we said, okay, let's look and see employment at the city. And when we looked and asked for the data, blacks only had menial positions in working for the city. So we began to march and protest for that. And Joe Mack Wilson, although he was a former mayor of Marietta, and we looked at Joe Mack as a racist mayor. And of course we were, anytime you take part in a movement like that, there's a tendency to label the leaders as radicals. And Hugh was labeled as a radical, and I was labeled as a radical, and several others who we actually believed that our phones were tapped and everything, and that the FBI was, anybody that they say was radical at that time, you know, the FBI, from that standpoint. But Joe Mack Wilson, who ran for mayor, and he was very vocal in his opposition to our movement. And now we are well into the 70s. And it was at that point that I had my Damascus Road experience, where I gave my life to the Lord. I was converted. And we received a call from Joe Mack, and he was wanting to know if we would support him in his efforts for mayor. And I said, man, you gotta be kidding. Mm-hmm. I said, the racist comments that you've been making, and you want us to support you in mayor? I said, no way.
But do you remember what year this is?
I'm thinking now this was in the early 70s, 74 or something like that, I think. And he made a profound statement. He said, if I can see that the Lord has changed you. He said, if the Lord changed you, what would make you think that he couldn't change me? So those words that he spoke resonated in my spirit. And we got together with caucus and we decided, okay, let's see. So we said, okay, we've been trying for several years, unsuccessfully, to get blacks jobs with the city. If we support you, what are you going to do to put blacks in positions with the city there? And he made a promise that he would. We supported him, he won. And that was the beginning for him, because he did what he promised to do. Mm-hmm. Joe Mack Wilson. So, and we thought that was interesting from that standpoint. As a result, and a lot of this was taking place in 1972 to 1978. I served on the Marietta City School Board. Professor Woods was the first black to serve on the school board. I was the second to serve on the Marietta City School Board. As a result of all of our activity, they said, well, maybe we need to put someone on the Civil Service Board, police department. I was appointed to the Civil Service Board. And they had now we had Dana Eastham. I don't know if that name. He was a mirror. Mm-hmm. And there was still, even though integration had taken place and we were making progress, there was still a lot of areas. He said, I'm going to form a commission, a council, if you will. It's going to be the Mayor's Council on Human Relations. So he formed that, and he asked me if I would co-chair that commission. And as a result of that, we did an awful lot to bring about, because even though in 1966, going back to 1966, we did an awful lot from the standpoint of that council to fuse the communities and to eliminate a lot of friction that existed in the community. So it was nothing like just, okay, the civil rights laws are passed and everything that happened then is over, and it was a gradual process that transpired. When we look at going back to Hugh, and one of the things that happened when Hugh, and this was in 1966, I believe it was, 1966 that Hugh came back to Marietta. When we looked at it, was very clear to us that gerrymandering had taken place, and they were systematically, when we look at what we call Baptist Town, I don't know if you all familiar with what Baptist Town, Fort Hill, which is here, when you look at what used to be called a racetrack, all those were the areas. Now, we had Louisville. All of those areas were such that they were segmented. And what the council had done, they had deliberately dissected the black community to where it was virtually impossible for black to be elected to any position. So what we did in the basement of my home, secretly we met. And
can I ask to clarify who we are?
Okay, we had Hugh Rogan and myself. We had this person did not, Frank Sexton, who also lived up down here. We had James Gober, who later ended up working, he was working for the Marietta Housing Authority, and he was over the R69 project, which was the Baptist Town slum area, Johnson Street, which we call Skid Row. And the housing project, the housing authority overtook that project, said we're going to clean up this area. So to try and get a buy-in from the black community, we'll put a black over this project, which was R69, and that was what it was called. And from that project, we decided, okay, what we need to do is look, and going back to the lesson that we learned when we initially went to the council and was asking about why there were no blacks, we said, okay, in every venture, what we need to do is get our minds together, make sure that we re-research any action that we would take to make sure that we have all of our facts and everything. So what we did, we got copies of all seven wards of Marietta, and we drew them out in different colors, and then we looked and said, okay, they have systematically gerrymandered our community to where it's virtually impossible. So we said, okay, what do we want to do? Hugh, at that time, he was doing consulting work. I was working for the Postal Service as a letter carrier. Everybody else, James was working for the Housing Authority. So everybody that was working, even though we worked together on the project, everybody except Hugh had an accountable job that if they could go after you, get you fired from your job. So we said, okay, Hugh, you'll be front. You'll be the front man. And that was why only Hugh's name was on that court case.
Mm-hmm.
Because they couldn't come after him for his job because he was virtually self-employed. Rest of us had jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you will recall, this was a pattern throughout the Southeast that if you participated in any type of protest or activity, your job was gone. They would fight school teachers to lose their job.
Mm-hmm.
Any other job that you had that they could be influential in getting you fired, you would lose your job.
Do you remember Mr. Grogan's reaction when this decision was made?
Oh yeah, precisely. What, like I said, every action that we took was in our basement. When we filed, when the suit was filed, and we said, well, we felt good that we would win the suit because it was so clear as to what they had done. Now, after the suit was won, then they, Judge Moyer came back and said, okay, here's what you're going to be required to do. You're going to be required to redistrict the wards. So we went back to work again in the basement. We said, okay, let's see what we can do to assure that we have a majority black ward, ward five. And that was what we went after because, again, we knew that Baptist Town, Fort Hill, all of the area, if we could get to where we had Ward 5, and if I remember correctly, somewhere between 55 and 57% of what we submitted, and I think at this point now the city was a little on the edge because they didn't want to be in violation, they agreed and the courts approved the submission that we made. It was not like the mayor of the city council drew the lines and said, okay, this is what we want. We were the ones that said, okay, this is what we want. And we insisted, and that was what the courts accepted, was to wear the, in other words, it was almost like you could, in some sense, say reverse gerrymandering,
mm-hmm.
but what we did was put right what really had been wrong in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how that came about.
can I bring us back a little bit actually to Lemon Street High School and get, were you here for Principal Woods?
No, he was here before.
Okay.
Professor Woods, I'm trying to think when it became Lemon Street. Professor Woods was the first. He was the first principal of Lemon Street. Now, when it was Perkinson High, that was somewhat before my time.
Okay.
I just remember the history. I remember that was a, I won't call it a cornerstone because it was not on the corner. They still had the marble inscription, Perkinson High School,
mm-hmm.
even though it was Lemon Street.
Okay.
And I remember Professor Woods was, everybody just, I mean, they looked up. They looked up to him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was the epitome. Even in his senior years, that was a creek. A branch that is still run on the other side of the property over here. And the boys, we would like to sneak off and go down and play in the creek doing school. And Professor Woods, and even at his upper age, he could almost outrun any of the kids. So when we would see him coming, I mean, we were all scattered different ways. And that was one of the things that we would remember. Back during that time also, it was okay for, school teachers could paddle. I mean, and he had his fraternity paddle. And he would, when you would cut up, you would be sent to Professor Woods, and you knew you were gonna get a paddle with that paddle. I think that was one of the things that caused the kids at that time to really just, we didn't have the problems we had then that we have now. We just didn't have those kind of problems. And I think a lot of it had to do with the care and the concern that individuals like Professor Woods and like some of the other teachers that we had, they were like an extended parental figure. And everybody respected the teacher. Everybody, teachers at that time came to school like they were going to church. They dressed like they were going to church. And you really looked up to the teachers. I mean, it was, and because you had the sense that they cared for you. And I think that's not what we have today. And plus, we have a situation today where you have several generations of young people, particularly in the black communities, you have two and three generations of young people that are unchurched. And when you have that situation, that draws from their ability to refrain from doing wrong, refrain from doing right, and encourage, they're encouraged by their peers to do wrong. And of course, I think you all saw what was taking place in Chicago yesterday, and all those folk up there to try to figure out what's going on with all of the teen violence in Chicago. Yeah. Everybody from Holden to everybody else is up there trying to figure it out.
Now. Yeah. Yeah, that was, but that video.
You have that everywhere. It's not just in Chicago. It's everywhere. That's an awful lot when you look at what is transpiring today in the black community that you might have put your finger on to say, what is the root cause of all of the violence? But I personally believe that a lot of it goes all the way back to when you had desegregation versus integration, and the care and the nurturing that black kids received then that they're not receiving now. And I think that has had an impact, but the largest impact, like I said before, I think has to do with when you have parents that are nothing more than children themselves, and you have three generations, and the oldest one is 30, or 31.
Yeah.
I had a situation in my one church in Pastor Birmingham, had a mother that was 29 years old, and a grandmother at 29 years old.
Wow.
She had a child when she was 15, and the child she had a child when she was 14. 29 years old in Britain.
Yeah.
And I think that weighs heavily on the problem that we're having today.
Absolutely. Yeah. Can I ask you what you remember about the violence in Birmingham and integration in Marietta? How would you compare the two?
I know the things that we experience here in Marietta minuscule compared to what took place in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Birmingham for 12 years, and oftentimes when we had people that would come visit us, one of the places that we would take them would be the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum. Without a doubt, I think that's probably the best civil rights museum in the country. and fittingly being in Birmingham, which is the seat of what was going on at that time. I don't think when you look in Kelly Park there in Birmingham, there's a statue of a policeman, and he has one of the canine dogs, and there's a black kid that's posing like this, like, okay, this dog is gonna bite me. That image of that statue, you, was what you were seeing on television.
Yeah.
You were seeing the real thing. That image of the fire hoses, and I'm sure you're aware of the pressure that a fire hose has, that when you direct that fire hose at an individual, that it has such force that it will just literally throw that person across the room from that standpoint. When you actually saw that, probably, I don't know if you all have seen films of what was going on, but to go through the Civil Rights Museum is almost like you are reliving that moment. The actual bus that was bombed, they have part of it in the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum. The bus that Rosa Parks was on.
There.
Wow.
They got part of it.
Oh, wow.
In the Birmingham Civil. So it's like you actually are reliving that experience when you visit the museum. There really is no comparison, because at no time during when we were protesting here, at no time did our protest turn really violent. Mm-hmm. And I do give the city credit for saying, hey, as long as these protests are peaceful, we need to give them some space. But I don't think it could come close to comparing what we did, because of the number of persons that were killed, number of persons that were mistreated, and we had none of that took place during the protests that we were making here in Marietta.
What other sort of opposition did you encounter, though? I mean, you talked a little bit about Joe Mack Wilson, and because, you know, there was media coverage for your protests, did you receive, like, outlash from the white community, or?
The only outlash that came from the Thunderbolt, which was, I can't think of his name now. He published the Thunderbolt, and he was a renowned, I mean, vocally a racist. I can't believe I can't think of it.
Was that a newspaper or a magazine?
It was a newspaper,
okay.
The Thunderbolt. I cannot think of his name as well as I know it. And he would publish things in the Thunderbolt that were an affront to the black community. And I can't think of his name now. But we never had any situation that we had with Lester Maddox, things that Lester Maddox was doing with his accent and his restaurant, etc. We never had any situation like that to come from that standpoint. I would think probably the because each time that we would protest, it was like somebody from the white community would say, hey, maybe we can get together and work this out. So, and I do give the city credit for that. And I think that was part of the reason that we had a number of positions in the city that were appointed at that time. Members to the school board were not elected; they were appointed. Jeannie Carter was the first black member of the school board to be elected, and she's retiring now. She was the first to be elected. Up until that time, all of the blacks on the school board were appointed by the city council. And the city council made it a point, hey, we need to have a black on the school board. Mm-hmm. And they took the initiative. Mm-hmm. So we have to give the city credit. And I think even back during those early years, we have to give the city credit, even though it took some nudging, mm-hmm. arm twisting, mm-hmm. what have you. Once that took place, they would come through from that standpoint. But at no time did we have a situation where there was a single arrest. It was always like, before it escalated to that point, let's see what we need to do. Mm-hmm.
Did you receive that same support from the new residents of the new Ward 5, from the white community in the new Ward 5?
I think so. I mean, we still have a situation now where, incidentally, you know, Hugh Grogan was the first black to be elected to the city council. Okay. One of the things we were truly together.
Okay, we should begin.
Yeah.
Let's have our ducks lined up that we can assure ourselves that we're going to get a black elected to the Ward 5. Because the strategy was and is, if you split the black vote and force a runoff, historically, blacks do not go back to the vote in a runoff. So we made sure that Hugh was going to be the candidate, mm-hmm. and he was elected. Mm-hmm. But now we find that later on, when everybody was saying, oh, okay, I think I'd like to run, we had the exact situation that transpired to where there were two blacks and one white. Neither of the blacks got 50% plus one. Forced a runoff with the white candidate. The whites went back to the poll and voted, the blacks didn't. So we lost that seat.
Is this the 81 election?
The 81 election. We lost that seat. So, now.
I've heard that there was some controversy with that runoff.
Yeah. I'm like,
do you believe that there was any underhandedness?
I don't know. I really don't. And I guess from my ministerial standpoint, I guess I would say, since I don't, I don't really address it from that standpoint. But I will say this, we have the exact same situation that's transpiring right now, mm-hmm. between and Ward 5. We have two black candidates and one white candidate.
So it's
going to be interesting to see how that plays out, or if that will be a replica of the 1981 election.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let me ask you, going back again to Lemon Street, who were some of the, besides Professor Woods, who were some of the people that made an impression on your life, the teachers?
There were a number of teachers that made lasting impressions. Probably one that
is a history teacher we had by the name of Lewis Scott. He's still living. He was so strict in his class, he insisted that you do well. And he would drill in our minds that you must, he says, it's absolutely necessary that you use rational, critical, and analytical thinking. That was in 1958, and I can still, he would stand up, we had radiators, not like these kind, but the old steam radiators. He would stand up on the radiator and lecture, and he would make statements like rational, critical, and analytical thinking. Unless you use those three, you will not be successful in life. And it was like, those words just resonated in your spirit. And we had an English teacher by the name of Miss Fred. She must have weighed 270 pounds. But she walked, it was like she was floating. And she walked. And she was just like Mr. Scott. She insisted that when you were in her class, she said, you're out there, you might want to talk like you in the street, but when you're in my class, you will enunciate, you will do this, you will do that. And I think about that now as the impact that she had on the lives of so many of us. And there were a number of other teachers. We had an algebra teacher by the name of Mr. Johnson. And he was real tough too. But the thing was, everybody in the class knew that they were caring about. Mm-hmm. It was not like you were just in there and the teacher said, I'm just trying to get to 3:30. Mm-hmm. If you said, hey, I got a situation and I need, can you help me after class? That teacher would stay there after class and help you with that situation. I cannot fathom that taking place. Mm-hmm. No, I just don't see that.
Sure. I have another question for you. As a class, we spoke to Deanne Bonner, who's the current president of the NAACP. And she used one word to kind of define Hugh Grogan, and she used the word fighter. I was wondering if you had a similar word that you would use to describe Hugh, and if so, why would you choose
one
that word?
One word?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And the reason I would say that Hugh was brilliant was because Hugh, during that time, I would think he was ahead of his time. A lot of people in the black community, a lot of folks don't know this, but a lot of people in the black community, not only was by the media and the powers that be, say he's a troublemaker, a lot of people in the black community were saying, why is he causing this upheaval? Why is he doing what he's doing? And it goes back to the saying, a little knowledge is dangerous. And the people that were making those type comments, some of them had no knowledge, and some of them had little knowledge. But I say Hugh was brilliant because he was a researcher of researchers. He spent an awful lot of time of everybody that we had. Probably Hugh spent more time researching than the rest of us collected. And when we would come together and he was, okay, this is what I found, it was like, okay, we know he's done the research, so we don't even have to double check. We know it's going to be right. Mm-hmm. I would say that brilliant was the word.
Really?
And I was fortunate to do his eulogy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And one of the things that I commented on at his eulogy was the fact that he was brilliant.
Perfect. No, not perfect. But he was great.
Was a lot of his research done here at the AAD?
A lot of it was done locally. A lot of it was done at state level, some at national level. So depending upon what we were trying to gather, the information. He researched other cases across the country on gerrymandering to kind of get a feel for really what was, gerrymandering. He had it together when it came to getting information and having that information available to us. Mm-hmm. We had confidence that if he had researched it, it would happen.
Do you remember, was he approached by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, or did he go to them, or how they became involved with the case?
I think that was a request that was made.
Okay.
That was a request that was made. Okay. Because at the time, here again, we had never ventured in this arena before.
Mm-hmm.
So we had situations where we would call in the NAACP, SCLC, and I never will forget at one rally. It was kind of interesting because at that time, the old Zion Baptist Church, all of the new complex, none of that was there. And the old church, that was Zion Baptist Church. That was one of the focal places where we would meet in the old Zion Church. Mm-hmm. And we could have easily been labeled as extreme, from the standpoint of Marietta, extreme militants. And we had an individual, I won't call his name because he's still here, from Southern Christian Leadership Conference come up and charge us. And we were all there in the church. And about one-third of the way through his talk, he used a four-letter word. And it was like everybody in the church, oh. So that, when everybody like sighed, like, he realized, I've said something that I shouldn't have said.
Yeah.
But even as intense as that moment was, everybody in that church in the pack realized we're in the Lord's house.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're in the Lord's house, we can use words here.
Uh-huh.
And it was amazing how, I mean, it was almost in unison, like the whole crowd. And he used that for that.
How closely would you say the Marietta community in a large focus, how close do you think they followed the gerrymander case and the redistricting?
I really don't think it was followed that much because we didn't want to really just blow it up. We wanted to just quietly do it. You know, the paper knew. And they New Grogan, filed lawsuit in the 5th District Court for gerrymandering. And people just kind of like pressed it off.
Mm-hmm.
But when the ruling came down, it made big headlines. Mm-hmm. And of course, it made even bigger headlines. Hugh ran for the city council and was elected as the first black councilman in the history of the city.
The attorneys for the city, some of their paperwork that they submitted to the court was pretty disparaging. Do you remember seeing any of that paperwork or any of the reactions to it?
If I remember correctly, one of the things that when we were seeing what the attorneys for the city were saying, it was like how we felt like what they submitted would help us more than it would then. Mm-hmm. And I think it did.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Do you have any other questions?
Not necessarily about the case, but...
Okay. Sorry.
No, that's fine. So, I mean, you've seen a lot of changes in Cobb County and in Marietta over the years. Is there anything in particular that sticks out to you in terms of race relations or people? Like, what changes have you noticed?
There is a number of changes that have taken place. One being when... I don't know if you all followed the busing case that was in Boston, Massachusetts. If you ever did research on it, but that was an awful uproar in Boston, Massachusetts, because the courts had ruled that there was an appreciable number of white students that had to be bused. And I mean, it was in the national media for weeks, what was taken, almost to the point to where they weren't rioting, but it was a mess in Boston, Massachusetts.
Was this recent, you're saying?
And the thing was that they were going to have to bus these white kids, not necessarily into black communities, but because of the disparity in the breakdown, they were going to have to equalize, and some of the students, the white students in the Boston school system, were going to have to be bused. And I thought back, I said, now, and they were talking about how horrible this was, and my mind went all the way back to what I alluded to earlier, when all of the black kids in Cobb County, many of them were bused right by white schools and bus all the way here to Lemon Street to go to school. And at no time were we complaining. All of those years that transpired, at no time. And I thought, why would they have the audacity to, when they're just trying to equalize the populace in the school system, to cut up the way that they were, after we did that for years and years and years. And that was one of the things that stuck in my mind. Now, you said, what has changed? Years back, the population in Cobb County, that was about 3% of the population of Cobb County, that were black. At the time, if you were black and you lived in Atlanta and you mentioned Marietta or Cobb County, it was put on a parody of Cumming, which was the last stronghold. I don't know if you all remember or if you've researched, you all probably young, went too young, when Hosea Williams decided that he was going to take buses to Cummings. And they were literally ran out of the county. Have you all done research on that?
No, I haven't.
Oprah Winfrey did a show in Cummings that was an aftermath of the incident with Hosea when he was ran out of Cummings. That was why Oprah went and did the show that she did in Cummings. Okay, now, Cobb County was not far from being thought of like Cumming, 3%. Mm-hmm. Most of the blacks in Cobb County were in Marietta. Mm-hmm. You had a smithering of blacks in Atwood, Powder Springs, Austell, just a few, not that many, just a few, okay? Now, quietly, when you look at blacks and Hispanics, blacks and Hispanics are soon to be the majority in Cobb County. Where my church is located, in Mapleton, Georgia, Southwest Cobb County, if you look at Southwest Cobb County, it's predominantly black and Hispanic. You have some of the largest churches, Bishop Brunner, Word of Faith, 8,000 members, Southwest Cobb County. World Changing Ministries, 3,000 members. These black churches I'm talking about, Southwest Cobb County. World Changing Ministries, Southwest Cobb County. Okay, you have Hurt Road, AME Zion Church, 2,500 to 3,000 members, Southwest Cobb County.
Has anyone in your congregation been affected by the floods?
Yes,
September
2009? Four families in our congregation that were impacted by a flood from that standpoint. So you said, what's changed from now to what was then? That is the most significant change. Up until the last election, you know, they had the first black commissioner from Southwest Cobb County. And of course, she cut up. She didn't, she didn't get reelected. So she couldn't keep her finances straight. And so blacks said, hey, we can't support you from that standpoint. But that's probably the greatest change that I see from that standpoint. I see now even the county is making, we have, as you know, one of the most proficient and recognized county managers, Dave Hankerson, black, who is the manager for Cobb County. We have in Cobb County now a number of blacks that not on elected posts, but appointed posts. 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, in Cobb County, not Marietta, but Cobb County, I was appointed to the Cobb County Board of Ethics, and that would have been unheard of years ago from that standpoint. So there are a number of things that's taking place in the county. The Cobb County Police Department is more diverse than the Marietta Police Department in terms of minorities. So I do see a lot of changes that have taken place over the years that years back I never would have fathomed that I would live to see some of the changes that have taken place.
Well, I think we covered your life up to about late 70s, early 80s. Do you want to tell us what you've been up to since then?
Well, my career, I started out as a letter carrier. This is interesting, in Marietta. In 1964, we had a postmaster by the name of Pierce Cody. And there were three blacks that were given jobs at the post office in Marietta. We were the first three blacks in the history of the Marietta Post Office to be hired. And I remember Postmaster Cody calling us in his office, and he lectured us, and he said, now, you all are the first, back during that time they used the expression, they used black, colored. So you all are the first colored to be working at the post office. And he gave us a spiel about what we needed to do, how we needed to carry ourselves and everything. And I remember the other two, we said, wonder what are they going to do with us? And starting out, they wouldn't let us deliver mail or collect mail in the white community. It was only around the square in Roswell Street and in the core black communities, i.e. Baptist Town, Fort Hill, Louisville, those were the three. And I remember very vividly when we would go, and back then everybody was walking with the satchel on their shoulder, and people in the community would say, here comes Garrett, or here comes Adams, or here comes Moon. And it was like they were proud to see that, hey, we have three blacks working at the post, because that had never happened before. And that was a highlight from that standpoint. And of course, the Lord blessed, because I spent 34 years in the Postal Service. Started out as a letter carrier, and in 1999, I retired as the district manager of customer services and sales for the whole state of Alabama. So, you said, what was I doing working?
Yeah. When did you become a reverend?
In 1983, I accepted the call. I had been teaching the Bible study. I came out of Turner Cathedral. Mm-hmm. That's my old church. And the original church was downtown Marietta, right where the Cobb County Administrative Office is now. That was where our church owned about half of that. Mm-hmm. Had a big, nice, big church. It had gotten old and everything. And it fell under the R69 project. And they call it R69 because it was in 1969. That was residential rehabilitation. And what happened was we relocated from there to where the Lawrence Street swimming pool is, the church that sits up on the hill. That was where we relocated to, okay? And we worshiped there. But I taught Bible study for several years before I accepted the call into the ministry. But in 1983, I accepted the call into the ministry. 1987, my job started to transfer me to different areas. I spent a year in Oklahoma City, a year in Beaumont, Texas, a year in Tampa, Florida, a year in Memphis, Tennessee. And ironically enough, when I found out that I was going to get a promotion to Birmingham, I almost turned it down, because I had some apprehension about going to Birmingham because of the former reputation that Birmingham had. So I prayed about it, and I accepted the position as the director of field operations in Birmingham. I ended up buying a second house. And I told my wife, this was kind of strange, I said, don't put any pictures on the wall. Keep remnants of carpet under the furniture, because we're not going to be here. This is Birmingham. I was there 12 years. And if there was ever a place that I think that the people try and are still trying to rectify the stigma that was attached to a city, I think Birmingham is doing everything. And when I'm talking about this, I'm talking about the white residents. Mm-hmm. They're doing everything that they can to this day to try and distill the bad stigma that was placed on Birmingham during the civil rights era. But I stayed there 12 years, and then I relocated back here. After I retired in 1999, I stayed there for two more years. Well, the church that I had some projects going on at the church, and I wanted to stay there to see those projects through to fruition. And in 2002, I came back, and we started a new initiative in Mapleton. And the reason that we chose the Mapleton area, after we had prayed about it, we had done a demographics, and it showed, hey, there's a lot of black folk living in this area. And even the demographics showed the percentage that were unchurched, et cetera, and everything. So we said, hey, this is an opportunity that we can start a church here. Mm-hmm. And we did. We started the church in 2003. And we have right about 300 members now. Hmm. So that's what we're doing.
It sounds like, obviously, you've been very active over your life in the Lord's work and politics, local politics. What would you say is your proudest accomplishment?
Probably, without a doubt, my proudest accomplishment has been from, even though I relish everything that the Lord blessed me to be a part of, and with civil rights, my proudest accomplishment is has to do with my ministry. I mean, by far. When I can take and be a part of a child that's going down the wrong road, and I can say, hey, I've been in some way a small part of the rehabilitative process of that child to get that child on Straight Street. And then that child called me back and said, Reverend, I'm graduating from Morehouse. I'm sending you an invitation to my graduation. Reverend, I remember you saying this to me years ago, and I believe the Lord is calling me into the ministry. I mean, when I get those type of response, I think that's, to me, that's the crowning jewel of my existence from that standpoint. And in terms of everything that the Lord blessed me to be a part of with reference to civil rights, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of that. I think that drive that I had and I still have enabled me, even in my career. For instance, when I went to Alabama, there were 550 post offices in Alabama. 11 black postmasters. When I became district manager, I said, I think we need to try and improve our diversity in this state. When I retired in 1999, we had 76 black postmasters across the state of Alabama. Mm-hmm. I feel good about that. Mm-hmm. I think that was a carryover from my involvement in civil rights. But what it did, it allowed me to work within the existing framework, within the system, and not be upset, but to do systematically what we could do to improve the life of a lot of minorities. I'm proud of that accomplishment, that I can say I had a small part in improving the lifestyle of a number of individuals that perhaps may not have had that opportunity had I not been in the position.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anything else?
No.
Right. Well, is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to discuss today?
No, it just I enjoy it. I always enjoy talking about situations that have existed over the years. I've enjoyed, I was looking forward to with anticipation to meeting with you all. And I really do appreciate the opportunity to have been here and to share with you.
Well, we thank you for your time.
Yeah.
We really appreciate it too.
Thanks for coming in. Yeah. Thanks for being with us.
Okay.